Anne Boleyn, Mary Queen of Scots, and Sir Walter Raleigh all have something in common. They were all beheaded. Off with his head is a Shakespearean line from Richard III, first performed in 1633. Beheading was always the traditional execution method for British nobility and people of rank through the ages. However, in different cultures, the taking of heads have had a variety of reasons, including the belief that if you took another man's skull, they would become your slave for eternity in the afterlife. In today's episode, we'll be looking at some of these headhunters. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. Listener caution is advised for this episode, as there are very descriptive scenes. So, when we think of headhunting, we envisage a predominantly Pacific, South American, or African practice. But headhunting also happened in Europe, and where better to start than with my people in Bonnie Scotland, and the Celtic tribes around Europe. Pre-Christian Celts believed that the head housed a person's soul. The invading Romans recorded the tribes nailing heads to walls, or dangling them from the necks of their horses to intimidate their enemies. This was a persuading factor for Hadrian to build his 73-mile wall from sea to sea in 122 AD to keep the Picts confined to Scotland. Incidentally, this also inspired the Wall in Game of Thrones. In Europe, the practice survived until the early 20th century in the Balkan Peninsula. The Montenegrins have a history of blood feuds and headhunting. Mostly active in the 18th and 19th century, the Montenegrin headhunting practice played a minor role in raids and warfare. They indulged in large-scale raids that resulted in them taking many heads. The intention behind taking an enemy head for the Montenegrins was to prove their bravery and also to shame the enemy. They used a special knife called a hanzar to carry out this savage act. There was an unspoken rule amongst them that if two tribesmen wounded the same person, the man who took the first blood could claim the head. But let's look at three peoples who practice headhunting. The Maori people in New Zealand have tattoos and a practice called moko. This is achieved by chiselling a design into the skin and rubbing ink into it. Moko was chiselled into the face to create permanent grooves in the skin. The face was then carved like wood and pigmented. These tattoos would give the Maori warrior an intimidating, fearsome appearance. Each moko contains ancestral tribal messages specific to the wearer, and tattoos can be applied on many areas of the body. Needless to say, it's an extremely painful procedure. One of the reasons why the Maori tribes practiced headhunting was due to the ritualistic respect given to the heads, and indeed, deceased family members and important tribe members would have their heads preserved and would be brought out on special occasions. Heads would be taken from the enemy to mock or to ransom to rival tribes. In New Zealand, the heads of the enemy were dried and preserved so that tattoo marks and the facial features were recognisable. This practice led to a further development of headhunting when tattooed heads became desirable curios, and the demand in Europe for Maori trophies caused these heads to become a regular article of ships' manifests. Therefore, many Maoris were murdered to supply the trade, having been commissioned for this barbaric trade. The process of preserving these tattooed heads, which were known as moko mokai, is as follows. The process would begin with the severing of the deceased person's head. This would be followed by the removal of the brains and the eyes. The orifices of the head would be filled with flax fibre and gum. Next, the head would be boiled or steamed before being smoked over an open fire. After this, the head would be dried under the sun for several days. Finally, the preserved head would be treated with shark oil. For ancestral reasons, the Maori are currently negotiating with many foreign museums and collectors for the return of their ancestors. In 2012, the French authorities returned 20 heads. In feudal Japan, the samurai also had a practice of headhunting, but for different reasons. Payment. During battles, the samurai would collect the heads of their opponents. Once taken, the heads would be returned to the base camp for registration. The enemy's head was proof of a samurai's duty done. After a battle, heads were collected from their owners and presented to their feudal lords, who were called daimyo. These leaders would enjoy a relaxing head-viewing ceremony to celebrate their victories. The name of the victor, his weapon used, any other circumstances regarding the duel, and the name of the head was recorded on a piece of stiff paper and tied to the hair. Rewards for their service would include gold, silver, and the land of the defeated being granted to the samurai by their daimyo. The heads would be thoroughly washed, had their hair combed, perfumed, and teeth blackened. This was a sign of gentry. Each head was then set on a small wooden holder for display. This was the role of specially trained women. One such woman was Oan, the daughter of a samurai. She experienced the horror of sleeping beside a collection of severed heads in Ogako Castle in the time of the Battle of Sekigahara in 1600. The castle was under constant attack from the superior forces of Tokugawa Ieyasu, and the description of her work with the heads is as follows. My mother and I, as well as the wives and the daughters of other retainers, were kept in the castle's keep, casting bullets. Severed heads taken by our allies were also collected in this area of the castle. We attached a tag to each head in order to identify them properly. Then we repeatedly blackened their teeth. Why did we do that? A long time ago, blackened teeth were admired as a sign of a distinguished man, so we were asked to apply a generous coat of black dye to any heads with white teeth. Even though those severed heads no longer held any terror for me, I used to sleep enveloped by the bloody odour of these old heads. Samurai were known to put incense inside their helmets, knowing that they may be killed, but honourably smelling nice for their killer. If there was no time for a full ceremony after the battle, a hasty ceremony would be arranged over leaves to soak up the blood. In one case, viewing conquered heads caused a daimyo to lose his own. After taking two of Oda Nobunaga's forts, daimyo Imagawa Yoshimoto halted his march for a head viewing ceremony and musical performance. Unfortunately for Yoshimoto, The rest of Nobunaga's forces advanced for a surprise attack as the heads were being prepared. Nobunaga's forces crept right up and attacked after a chance thunderstorm. It was then Yoshimoto's severed head became the centrepiece for a head viewing ceremony for his enemy. The head-based reward system was open for exploitation. Some samurai would say the head of a foot soldier was actually a great hero, and no one would know the difference. Sometimes after taking a valuable head, they would abandon the battle with their money already made. Things got so bad that daimyos sometimes prohibited taking heads so that their men could focus on victory instead of getting paid. As you might appreciate, collecting heads during battles wasn't always the easiest practice. Therefore, cutting off the upper lip and nose together was also acceptable. After the battle had ended, they would reunite the pieces like a macabre jigsaw puzzle, and the head would be properly cut off and reclaimed. Any heads missing the lip and nose were known as onakubai, or women's heads. The record number of heads taken by a single man in a combat was Kanai Saizo. This samurai fought at the Battle of Sekigahara, and he claimed 22 heads, but could only prove 17 kills. Phew, I'm glad the Japanese section's over, and I apologise to any native Japanese speakers for my pronunciation. I know I have at least one Japanese listener. Sorry, Yuriko. Lastly, the Jivaro Indians of Ecuador and Peru were headhunters, and quite literally, head shrinkers. This process of taking human heads and shrinking them down to about the size of an orange dates back to the ancient Incans. Jivaro warfare was motivated by revenge rather than territorial expansion. Thus, raids on enemy settlements were performed to avenge slain relatives. As a result, headhunting was undertaken to appease the spirits of slain ancestors. Jivaro warriors believed that the ritual of shrinking the head paralysed the spirit of their foe and prevented it from taking revenge, and also passed the victim's strength into the killer. These shrunken heads are called sansas. The process of making a shrunken head began by obtaining a human head in battle. A head was removed from the body by cutting the skin at the extreme base of the neck, just above the clavicles, and in a V-shape meeting at the point between the nipples. A hairband or vine was then passed through the open mouth. This allowed the warrior to carry his trophy home with ease. Once back at home, the warrior would make an incision up the back of the neck in order to peel the flesh away from the skull. The entire skull was then removed and thrown away. The eyes were then sewn shut and the mouth closed by passing small, sharp palm pegs through the lips. The skin was then put into a boiling pot and left to simmer for an hour and a half to 2 hours. It had to be watched, because too short a time would result in the head not shrinking properly, while leaving the head in too long would cause the hair to fall out. When the head was removed from the pot, it would be reduced by 2/3 of its original size and would have a rubbery texture. The skin was then turned inside out, and any flesh left on the inside of the skin was scraped away. After this, the head was dried so that it would continue to shrink. Small rocks heated by a fire were used to fill the cavity of the head. When the head became too small for the stones, heated sand was used instead. In addition, heated rocks were applied to the outside of the head to maintain the features This process lasted several days, after which the peg through the lips were removed and replaced with dangling cotton cords. Once the miniaturised head reached the desired size, the Jivaro used more hot stones on the outside of the face to both seal it and shape the features. Charcoal ash was then rubbed on the skin to darken it and keep the avenging soul from exiting the head. The mini head was then hung above a fire to harden it and blacken it. Finally, the mouth was sealed for good with a string. Once this was completed, the head was attached to a cord through the scalp and worn around the warrior's neck. The process of producing the shrunken head ended with a celebration and a feast. Once these rituals were complete, the shrunken head had served its purpose for the warrior. Its significance was in the process of creation and not the final product. Robert Ripley collected his first shrunken head from a trader in Panama City in 1923. He would go on to found Ripley's Believe It or Not. The trade would flourish in the Western world, and there are suggestions that several heads were bought to order. The practice of head shrinking is now banned, yet the Jivaro still do a good trade in replicas of shrunken heads. They are clearly labelled as replicas and are made from animal products. Well, that's all for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I hope you enjoyed that. If you want to see pictures of these heads described in today's episode, join me on the Twitter group, the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast, to view these. Also, subscribe to the podcast, tell your friends, and I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.